Hello and welcome to the Astana International Financial Center's Legal Tech Podcast with your host, Mark Beer.
It is a great pleasure to be able to talk with Dr. Sam Muller today, the founder of the Hague Institute for Innovation of Law and a man with a mission, to improve the lives of 150 million people by 2030. Dr. Muller, it's a pleasure to be able to chat with you today. And please tell me more about this incredible mission.
Well, it's a wonderful mission. It's also at times a hugely scary mission. But it may sound like a lot. In many ways, it is a drop in the ocean. In 2019, last year, I was part of a small international coalition that tried to work out how big the justice gap in the world is. And our definition of the justice gap was, how many people basically lack adequate access to justice in the world. And together with the World Justice Project, the World Bank, the OECD, some of the data that Hill had collected, and the work of Namati, the elders, and lots of others, we came to the conclusion that a little over 5 billion people in the world do not have adequate access to justice. And that ranges from people who are in de facto slavery, to people who don't get civil things around, their houses, their family, their land resolved, to people that basically live in informality without any protection of the law. So if you look at that and you then put that against the 150 million, then I have these moments where I think, oh my God, it's not enough. And I also have moments where I think, how are we going to do the 150 million? Because that's not going to be easy either.
Sam, that is incredible. So if I've understood you correctly, more people around the world have access to the internet than have access to justice. Is that right?
I think it's a good way of saying it. And there are more comparisons that make this so worrying. So if you look at the numbers in terms of access to health in the world over the last decades, you could see that it's continuously gone up. If you look at access to education, it's continuously gone up. If you look at access to justice, it has not. In fact, I would say as more people started living on planet Earth, we haven't caught up in getting normal access to justice for them. And I'm talking about the kind of justice, I sometimes call it mundane justice. It's the daily stuff. If you have a small business and somebody doesn't deliver what he or she promised to deliver, somebody doesn't abide by a contract that you concluded, if your husband kicks you out of your house or doesn't pay the alimony, if the neighbor takes a part of your land, I mean, all these things that happen in daily life, which are bound to happen, which is, I guess, part of being human, they need a way of resolving them. And the way I like to put it, but then I am making it a little bigger, is that, that the most valuable capital, I believe, and research supports this, that a country has, perhaps worth more than money, is its relationship capital. If your relationships in a country work well and you're poor, you're better off than if your relationships are very rich and you have bad relationships. It feeds into social cohesion, it feeds into trust, and it also feeds into ultimately economic development. So in many ways, the justice system for me has to be a relationship management system that helps people maintain relationships in a productive way, and relationships between people inevitably go wrong every now and then. And that's a different approach than I think we generally take to justice systems.
So why is it that countries around the world have focused so much on education, on the next generation, on improving the lot of the youngsters in society, and focused so much on health and making sure that health is good and that society is a healthy society, and yet haven't, if I've understood you, have not focused on such a fundamental principle as people's rights and justice and fairness in society?
That is a very good question that I've asked myself a lot. And sometimes I feel it's a bit like fish in a dirty lake who don't really realize that they're swimming in increasingly dirty water. We tend to just grin and bear it. Also because who cares if my wife runs a small GP practice in the village? Who cares if she has a small employment problem for 2,000-3,000 euros, which she can't really solve, which for a small GP practice is a lot of money. But solving it in the official justice system will probably cost her 10,000. So she grins and she bears it. And I think there's a lot of that going on. There is also, I think, the fact that the when you talk about a disease, take heart disease, we have lots of data to show that it's happening. We've worked out how much suffering that causes, how much unemployment that costs, how much well-being that costs, et cetera, et cetera. We lack such data on the whole in the justice sector. We don't really know what's happening. There is the beginning, but there's not enough rigorous, what I'd sometimes call justice epidemiology, that tells you what are the main justice diseases people have, what are the experiences people have in dealing with those problems, what's working and what's not working. It's in that sense, the voice of all those people that live with mundane justice problems doesn't really have a place in the system, while the children who don't get educated or the people who die of heart attacks, they do. And that really has to change. Which is why our first emphasis is so much on data, on making sure that we know what's happening.
But to come back, if we can continue that analogy, right? I read in one of your research reports that 1 billion serious legal issues a year exist around the world, which is effectively 1 in 7 people have a serious legal issue every year. Or, as I'm a lawyer and therefore terrible at maths, I'm going to extrapolate that to say everyone will have a serious legal issue every 7 years, right? On average. So if that's right, it's like saying, well, we'll all have a heart attack once every 7 years. We'll all have a disease that requires us to go to hospital once every 7 years. And society says, well, yeah, once every 7 years, we won't do too much about it. I mean, if you're really close to death, there'll be an ambulance. You know, there'll be some legal aid for you. And if you're really, really in trouble and you really want to, we can take you to the court system. But probably there's a 50-50 chance you might live or die in there. So it's up to you. They would be completely unacceptable for something as serious as a existential threat once every 7 years. So there must be a reason why states have prioritized health and education over law. And I wonder, Sam, is one reason the fact that in most countries, the health lobby, that is the power of the doctors and the respect that the doctors can garner in the media and politically, and the respect that teachers and education has, is very different to the way that people respect the legal community. Is that part of the problem?
I think you're right. I mean, this a similar example I often try to use, that we kind of know that only 1/3 of the people, just generally in the world, that tries to solve a legal problem succeeds. And I also say, you know, what if you have schools where only 1/3 of the children make it to the end? I mean, or 1/3 of the patients would only get better. I mean, we would not accept that. So, the numbers are staggeringly bad. We really need to look that in the face. I think the reason why we're accepting this is, there's like many things, not really one reason, but one of the things I hear a lot from the people that do justice needs studies and that work in the area of access to justice, that in many parts of the world, including rich countries, people just think this is part of life. That they don't think that this is something that could be helped. Just like perhaps 50 years ago, people accepted that if your grandmother had pneumonia, she'd die. Fine, she'd die. That's it. Accept that. That's part of life. And that, of course, that is something we really have to change. You know, this is not a normal, doesn't have to be normal. And it has a hugely eroding effect on society. It undermines trust. It undermines the ability to, and that's an argument I use a lot when I talk to government leaders. I say, look, this is also undermining for your economic development. But we lawyers have not been very good at showing that, at making that very clear and having an agenda. Most of what we lawyers have been doing, and I was part of it when I was also working for the United Nations and my career, we've been basically saying we just have to, yeah, and I'm being a bit facetious here, so it's a bit exaggerated, but to make the point, we need to write more laws, build more courts, train more lawyers. That's what we need to do. And that is very much reasoning from what lawyers have been taught as the solution. It's a bit of you know, if you have a hammer, then every problem is a nail. Rather than stepping back and saying, so what are we seeing here? Last night, I was at a very interesting event organized by the Royal Palace here online. And it was the presentation of literally translated, a platform to help people in huge debt. And up to now, the response of the justice system to people in debt had been to slam them with fines and to put them in jail, essentially. And this was a platform that had really completely turned things around, and it looked at, so what causes young people and very often poor people to end up with huge debts? What's happening there? What's their journey? What do they need? And that resulted in a platform that prevents people from getting into debt in the first place. And once they are in debt, recognizes that on time and does something about it. So the legal system doesn't even have to be involved, or if it is involved, it's supportive and only in the very, very, very worst cases where, you know, debt gets close to fraud, will you involve the legal system? And I think, you know, that's the kind of thinking, holistic thinking, where a problem debt, which in the legal system was only looked at in terms of fines and, if need be, prison sentences, and more legal interest piled on more legal interest, piled on more debt, piled on more legal interest, basically destroying people's lives, and then putting them in jail, which costs society even more, and then putting, I don't know how many legal procedures around that, going back to the problem and seeing what you could do about it. And I think that's an example of the way we should be looking at it.
I think, you know, how often have you and I spoken to judiciaries and to governments and said, you know, how are you getting on in the justice sector? And they said, oh, well, we need to recruit more judges. And you say, well, why is that the solution? But you hear it time and time again. You know, you take a system that doesn't work, you throw more people at it, and you hope that will suddenly fix it. But I love that story that you spoke about, you know, the Royal Palace. But it did raise a concern, because when I look at innovation and technology, and this is at the core of what you do, right, applying innovation to improve access to justice. When you look at innovation in the education sector, it's about helping teachers to deliver better education. When you look at med tech, and you look at technology and innovation in the health sector, it's about giving the doctor more and more data and information to help them make a better diagnosis or to deal with the situation in a better way. But whenever I hear people talk about law tech, so not like how to make law firms more efficient, which we'll call legal tech, but law tech, which is transformative to the legal system, it is almost always about excluding the current system, as you say, is how do we keep that out of the legal system? And I wonder, why is it that we, do you think that innovation and technology has not entered into the legal dimension of society? Why has it been so resistant to technology, or been allowed to be so resistant to technology in the context of access to justice?
Very, very good question, and maybe a little anecdote. My son is studying for his Dutch law degree, and last night or two nights ago, he sent me a paper that he had been asked to write, and he did a bachelor's in something very adventurous, and now he just needs to get this awful Dutch law degree. And he told me literally that I needed to check his paper whether he was using complicated enough legal language, because that's what he had been told to do, and not to be too colloquial. Are you serious? And he said, yes, I have to write like a lawyer, a very complicated language. And this is a reputable law faculty in the Netherlands, one of the best. That's what they're still teaching young graduates to do. He's taken a degree before this, a bachelor's degree called PPLE, which is politics, law, economics, and psychology. So he's got some background in data. He's got some background in behavioral science. He's got a broader mind. But if you look at the average law degree in the average country, it's law in the books, based on a reality from the books in most cases that you're dealing with. So why hasn't this changed? Well, as I said, I think one reason is that the voice of the consumer, the voice of the user, isn't there. And in the health sector, you see that there is an association of heart disease. There is one of the most powerful NGOs in the Netherlands is the Cancer Society. And they have a voice. They keep the. Secondly, I think we have a problem with the marketplace. The marketplace isn't organized in a way that it allows for innovation. And I am very much inspired by an organization in the medical sector called the Gavi Alliance, which is a global alliance that seeks to help countries, and they've identified a little over 70 of the poorest countries in the world to develop their own vaccines, and all part of Access to Health. And it's a very successful organization, a new way of doing development aid, public-private partnerships, all that. One of the strategic pillars of the Gavi Alliance is to organize a marketplace, which means they help countries organize the health market in such a way that it is interesting for private parties, that it is interesting for outsiders to move in and to try and help develop vaccines and treatments. That is a particular pillar of their work. And increasingly, I've reached the conclusion, we need something like that in the justice sector, because the justice market basically has, it, first of all, it doesn't include prevention of justice problems. So we have ministers of justice all over the world, and their job is to deal with justice problems once they arise. When I ask, and I often do facetiously in workshops, I say, who in your country is the minister to prevent justice problems? There isn't really anybody there. Nobody has this. Nobody holds this. That marketplace needs to include prevention, and it needs to conclude resolution as a goal. That's what it should be about. And at the moment, I think that marketplace has basically one delivery model, namely the lawyer, who gets often paid per hour to help somebody, and the judge, who basically gets paid by the government to solve as many disputes as possible. That is not a very healthy market, with only two suppliers and hardly any voice of the consumer. So I think that's the challenge. And if we don't really change that, I don't think that a lot of the legal or the law innovation, the access to justice innovation also that we work on is going to be very successful. The market has to be open to new delivery models. And there are new delivery models. We've identified them in our research. There are lots of ways in which you could get prevention and resolution solutions to people that don't consist of a traditional lawyer asking for fees per hour, and they need to get a place in the market. And that, I think, is what we need to start doing. Now, when you change a market, and this is where it becomes difficult, there will be winners and there will be losers. And I strongly feel we should open that discussion. In the Netherlands, we are paying farmers not to farm intensively anymore. We are paying, and I think it's happening in the EU as well, we're paying fishermen not to fish anymore. And maybe we should be paying lots of lawyers not to do law in the old-fashioned way anymore and help them transition to other business models, to other delivery models. Because it's hard to innovate if you, as a small, 5 to 10 person law firm in a particular province in the Netherlands or in the UK or elsewhere, want to really invest in a new business model, where are you going to get your capital from? Who's going to invest in you? How are you going to get the expertise to help you really do that? That's not easy in the current marketplace. So these things really, really need to change.
But we have seen, haven't we? I mean, if you go back years, the Australian government said, if you want Australian government legal work, you have to do certain things. And one of which was pro bono, helping your community. If you don't help your community, you won't get government work. And it was a significant incentive for especially the bigger firms to get involved. And what they found was productivity of lawyers, happiness of lawyers went up because they were doing what they always wanted to do, which was to help people. That's why people get into the law. And we're also seeing now post-COVID this acceptance by the legal profession that maybe you can do things differently as a profession. And what I think we're starting to see is, I think euphemistically called consolidation, but effectively law firms closing, lawyers leaving, and the rise of a new way of delivering law, alternative service providers, distributed law firms, and the like. They're on the rise because they don't carry the baggage of the legacy legal system. We're also seeing courts start to deliver justice in a different way. You know, I was chatting to someone the other day, and it took quite a bit of persuasion to get judges comfortable with using video technology. It's taking even more persuasion to get them back into the courtroom. So we are starting to see an adoption, a speed of adoption to reform that we've never seen before in the profession and in the court system. And I wonder, Sam, where is it going? You know, where do you think it's going? Is it going to be the court system that fills the justice chasm, this huge divide between what society needs and what the current justice system delivers? Will it be the private sector? Will it be a hybrid? Will it be innovation? Will it be technology? What's your prediction?
It's good that it's really good. And I think you're right to focus on some of the good news. I horrible as COVID is, it is causing some change. Although, you know, I was talking to an attorney general, and I don't want to be it, but this is just a funny story. I was talking to an attorney general from a country that I will not name, who had moved courts online and who was then sued by a group of lawyers in name of the Bar Association, in which they argued that moving courts online was a violation of the Constitution. And he had to spend 3 months this year. He had to spend 3 months fighting that into the Supreme Court. And he won. But I mean, it shows you how entrenched it still is. And much as I admire the pro bono thing, I think it is important, the point that I think we need to, the tipping point we need, and we can learn from the green sector. You know, they always said, if we want to fight climate change, we need a green economy. It's got to be interesting to invest in it. And I think we need a justice economy that has that is more than just what we have now, because it still isn't interesting. And I talk to a lot of social impact investors. It's still not interesting for them to invest in the justice sector. Why? Because of all kinds of complicated rules, because they don't know whether they will be sued. If you look at, for example, Demander Justice, a wonderful, really interesting, super innovation in France. The guys who set that up are fighting court cases all the time. I know similar cases in Germany. I know so many people who've run legal aid programs who've gone into trouble with the bar. And it's not because the bar are evil people, and it's not because judges are evil people or ministries of justice are evil people, not at all. It's just that we have, the incentives are not aligned in a good way. And I don't think we're having the honest conversations we should be having. And one example I like to use is the, what we in the Netherlands call the North Sea Accord, which was concluded last year, in which the tourism industry, the fishery industry, the agriculture industry, everybody who had an interest in the Dutch part of the North Sea got together, and they basically talked for about 4 years, and they hammered out, and they fought, and they talked, but it was not in the media, at least a lot of the conversation were not in the media, and they talked about the best way to use the North Sea that meets the requirements of all the different users. And one of the results was that there'd be a lot less fishing, but the fishermen would get financial help to move to something new. And you cannot ask the law firms of the world to just stop. And that would be a destruction of capital. So is there ways that you could, you know, help bar associations in the world slowly open up the market, develop, create investment funds, make it interesting for them to start delivering what I often call the Suzukis of justice, and because now most of what they do is provide Porsches, and not everybody needs a Porsche. Let's just get massive, you know, for the mass market stuff out there, and technology allows us to do that. It's not just technology, also what we know from psychology, behavioral economics, neurology. We know so much more about what makes people choose between one thing and the other, what escalates disputes, what makes disputes de-escalate, what helps people come together. All that knowledge, it's out there. It just needs to be incorporated in what we do.
To some extent, Sam, the market will do that, right? Let's not think that what lawyers deliver is any different to what other service providers deliver. Yes, there's a professionalism. Yes, it takes longer to qualify. But at the end of the day, the customer doesn't have to buy your loaf of bread. And so instead of, because I think politically trying to subsidize lawyers to change is going to be a hard one to get through any parliament. And there's just no sympathy for lawyers. And that's part of the issue, I suppose. But surely the market is going to adjust as customers start to be more demanding. That is, they're quite happy to go online. They're quite happy to have the vagaries of an AI-based solution. They don't want to use lawyers, so lawyers have to deliver something different to them. It's a grudge purchase. It's like going to the dentist, going to a lawyer, right? And so lawyers that can deliver differently will succeed over those that maintain the tradition. That's market economics. So isn't that what we're going to see, do you think? Or do you think that the lawyers are so sort of entrenched in having control of that legal advice market that it will require something else to have innovation?
That's a good one. I mean, I do think the trends are there to in the direction of the market, demanding stuff. But we mustn't forget that every year that we don't make changes, 1 billion people suffer. So can we wait for this gradual market thing to happen, or should we do more? And I firmly believe we should do a little more. It is happening, but we do need to help it along, because the, and not just to be nice, but also because I firmly believe it'll help deal with the many crises that we have now. There is no way that we will be able to deal effectively and keep the legitimacy of all the COVID measures that are being taken if we do not have some kind of relationship management system that works. Economic recovery in the next 2-3 years, which is going to be the name of the game for the whole world, is going to go slower if we don't have these things in order. And the World Justice Project has even done some very interesting work whereby they say, you know, they tried to work out how many more schools and hospitals we could build if there was more access to justice and justice, therefore, for example, less corruption. It's just massive. So the argument is fairly simple, but it takes I think a lot of and that's one of the things that we are working on. I believe for these kind of revolutions, you need grand political statements. You need really political leadership, which is slowly emerging. So last year we had the Task Force on Justice, you know, that has now transformed into the Pathfinders for Justice. Next week, we have a relatively small but quite significant summit of justice ministers that's been pulled together by Canada, the Pathfinders Initiative, the Open Government Partnership. And we've helped there as well to get a few ministers together to actually say, this has to change. That in itself is already great. But we also need what we call safe spaces where outside the political posturing, the different players in the justice market could come together and honestly talk about what is needed, what the losses will be, what the gains will be, who the winners are, who the losers are, and how we can make that transition. And those kinds of conversations, I think, are not always best held in big public events. They're held in behind closed doors. So that's one of the things that we're also working on with others to kind of start organizing those kinds of conversations. And those conversations are based on the data, on, listen, dear minister, this is what's happening. This is what's happening in your country, in your region. And one last thought I also have when I come back to this, why is it so hard to change? I think part of it was also because the legal sector found it very hard to envisage something else. And for a minister of justice, and I've talked to so many, you know, I always try and I've really learned to put myself in their shoes. If I have a tenure of 4 years and being a minister of justice is a very difficult, very difficult job. I've worked it out at one point that, you know, ministers of justice are amongst the most fired ministers in cabinets. Why? Because you only need one high-level prisoner to escape from prison and boom, you're out. I mean, a lot of stuff happens in the justice sector. So if you are a minister of justice, you're basically the boss of the courts, you're the boss of the prosecution, you're the boss of the bars. So the justice system is basically what you're supposed to oversee. Yet you have no control over that, because the judiciary is independent, the Bar Association is independent. So you're the boss, but you have very little control. You're responsible, but you have very little control. You're constantly under media scrutiny. Why, in that very, very risky environment, would you invest in innovation? You will only increase the risk of not making your 4 years. So we've got to make it, you know, possible, interesting, safe, worthwhile, a goal you can achieve, I think, for there to be movement in that area as well.
So let's finish up with this, Sam. Imagine the perfect Minister of Justice came to you in a perfect world with a perfectly infinite pot of money and human resource and talent and said, Sam, I'd like you to design me the perfect justice system. What three bits of advice do you think you would give them in terms of that perfect justice system?
Wow, that is a question I have never, never got. I guess I would say, first and foremost, let's work on your system itself, not what it delivers, but help, you know, I would advise him to build his system in such a way that it can figure out what is needed, that it has the space for people to come up with solutions, that it has the ability to then select what things are best, that it then has the safety for solutions that are not working to be ditched and to try something else without, you know, repercussions, etc., etc. And that it has the ability to take a holistic view of justice, so that it works right from the start with the Ministry of Finance, with the Ministry of Health, with the Ministry of Education, because all these things somehow fit into the justice paradigm. And I would say first focus on building that kind of system. And then if you educate good people, if you have, you know, and you have good people in your ministry and you have good people in the different justice institutions, innovation will come and your system will start delivering. I have talked to so many judges, at so many ministry officials who sometimes say, my moments of greatest pride was when I did something that the system didn't want me to do. So I you know, generally think that most of us come to the legal profession with a deep conviction, not everybody, but a deep conviction to try and help for justice. So if the system has a place for that, if a system allows those people to do what they would like to do, then the ideal justice system, I think, will slowly develop, and it will be different for each country. So there is also, it's hard to come up with one solution. In Uganda, we are working, as you and I were there, Mark. They wanted to strengthen the local council courts, which are these very local village-based courts with elected judges that help solve the mundane issues that arise in those village communities. They have a lot of legitimacy, they have some quality issues, whatever. Well, that's typical Uganda. That works really well. So with you in Uganda, you should, let's see if that could be strengthened. But in the Netherlands, we don't have that. We have something else. So I think that's also important, that each country has its own thing where you could strengthen it. But first and foremost, I would say invest in making your system open to the voice of the user, of the citizen, and open to innovation.
Thank you very much. Design orientated, citizen centric, innovative, even entrepreneurial, and interconnected. Fantastic advice, I think, there for all judiciaries and governments. Dr. Muller, it has been a huge pleasure spending time with you and listening to all of the wonderful work that you're doing and the vision that you've got to improve the lives of 150 million people by 2030. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
This podcast is being produced by the Astana International Financial Centre and moderated by the chairman of the AIFC Law Tech Advisory Council, Mark Beer. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to hear more information on the Astana International Financial Centre's Law Tech Advisory Council, please follow us on LinkedIn.